When the Sect Chief came to, it was morning instead of afternoon, and a bright sun was shining down warmly. His clothes were streaked with mud, but there was little blood, and he didn't smell like the Vil's shitter anymore. That was when he noticed the fat bullfrog sitting on his chest. As Sterling watched, the frog lashed out its long tongue to snare one of the flies buzzing around the man and swallowed it whole. Sterling ignored the whole cycle of life and grabbed the frog to twist its slimy neck and wolf it down. After a while, he felt nauseated, then better, more alert, and he rose to start his lone trudging along the foot of the imposing cliffs. Hugging the medkit, Sterling swatted at the flies and shuffled along with no idea where he was heading. An unclimbable cliff rose sharply to his right, and the lazy river flowed a dozen yards away, just past the buzzing weeds. Fish swam in abundance in the quiet river, and the Sect Chief was looking for a long stick to make into a spear. As he traveled, a rock broke off the face of the cliff and plummeted onto the ground. Obviously, this was a recent fissure, and the ground was still setting into place. It would be safer near the river, but the soft ground there made walking difficult, so Sterling chose speed and stayed on dry ground. If a rock took him out, so be it. Sterling was hungry, stiff, itchy, tired, filthy, unshaved, and couldn't take his mind off the faceless bastards who had gunned down his troops. But more than life itself, the Sect Chief wanted Delphi in blaster range. One clean shot was all Sterling needed. Walking along the riverbank, Sterling instantly paused when he heard the sound coming from the reeds. He clumsily drew his hand blaster and proceeded closer. Somebody was in the weeds. Sterling thumped back the hammer, wondering if it was one of the stickies from the previous day. Unwilling to leave a live enemy behind him, the wounded Sect Chief shuffled closer and parted the flowering reeds with the barrel of his blaster. A cloud of flies crawled over something in the muck. It looked like a pile of rags. But then the pile moved, and a very tall man with long hair tried to crawl out of the slippery mud, only to collapse after a few inches. The man's clothing was in tatters, and one boot was missing. There was a holster at his hip, but no gun or anything else that looked usable. Tucking away his own weapon, Sterling silently wished the outlander good luck, then started to leave. The brutal fact was that the Sect Chief could barely take care of himself, so there was no reason in the world to help a stranger.
Curse you, Delphi! Gonna ace you, bastard.
Snapping his head around at the sound of the name, Sterling went back to the reeds. His boots sank deep into the soft mud, but he grabbed the tall man under the arms and dragged him onto dry land. The effort took everything he had, and Sterling passed out from the exertion. Sometime later, the aching Sect Chief awakened. The sun was behind the cliff, which meant late afternoon. Forcing himself to stand, Sterling gathered some broken pieces of wood and built a small fire near the unconscious man. Then he used the canteen to rinse off the stranger's face. The fly stayed nearby and became less interested. The man's face was covered with tiny cuts, slashed in 100 places, the wounds dirty and only partially healed. Using his canteen, Sterling washed the man's face clean, then poured some raw shine over the cuts. He was no healer, but he knew that the mud in those cuts would form scars, lots of them. This poor bastard would have a face like a quilt, but Sterling guessed that was better than being killed. The man had to have fallen off the cliff and hit some rocks while he was in the river. Either that, or he just missed getting killed by a Gren. Time passed, and as the campfire diminished, Sterling went on the hunt again, this time finding a nice long piece of wood suitable for fishing. After tending the campfire, he waded into the shallows and got busy. In short order, there were several gutted trout dangling above the small blaze. The moment the fish were cooked, Sterling ate, stuffing himself like a Vil pig. Sleep was all he wanted now. The Sect Man got to his feet and waded out into the shallows of the cold river to get more supplies. Evening was approaching, and the tall man's eyelids fluttered open wide. Sterling looked up from cleaning his blaster.
Hungry? There's plenty. fish is dumber than gophers. And that's saying something.
His muscular neck trembling from the effort, John painfully lifted his head from the dry dirt.
Well, where the fuck am I?
Sterling shrugged.
The zone, I think. Don't know for sure. Could be anywhere.
Scowling at the response, John suddenly noticed the clean bandages on his wrist, then blinked in surprise when he found more on his bare chest. Where was his body armor? Oh yeah, he remembered ripping it off when he was drowning under the water. The smell of the fish was delicious, but John didn't think he could eat without being sick. His guts ached something awful.
What? Who the hell are you?
Finished cleaning his weapon, the Sec Chief started reloading the blaster.
Steve Sterling, Sec Chief for Tucsonville.
You never heard of the place.
John brushed back his damp hair. The river was yards away, the tracks of his boot heels in the mud telling a clear story. The stranger had saved his life. But why? Sterling holstered his pistol.
It doesn't matter, friend. My bill's a long distance from here. We are on our own.
Friend.
John's hand went to the empty holster at his side. Sterling noticed the gesture and looked the man in the eye.
We're both looking for a man named Delphi.
John nodded in understanding. The last Rogan brother weakly held out a hand.
The enemy of my enemy.
Blood for blood.
They shook to seal the bond.
Got any water?
Over by the fire, near the fish. Help yourself. I've already eaten.
Thanks.
As the tall man started to devour the fried trout, Sterling smiled in grim contentment. It looked like he had a formidable ally in the hunt for Delphi. Well, two blasters were certainly better than one. Yet the Sec Chief had a feeling that they might need an army to take down the White Coat. Fortunately, he knew just the place to get one of those. The electronic thrumming of the vast spherical chamber was interrupted by the Matrans effect. A hulking piece of machinery materializing in a nearby section of the base. Besides this new acquisition, the chamber was empty, save for a small station directly in the middle of the enclosure. On this station, two individuals were seated, although there were three chairs. On the back of the empty seat rested a small metal plaque with the word Delphi printed on it in large block letters. The other two occupied chairs held plaques that read Melphi and Kelphi, respectively. If Doc Tanner, any of the Rogan brothers, or Sec Chief Sterling had been in this chamber, they would have been awestruck by the sight of the two inhabitants, for they were exact copies of the Department Coldfire operative they had met near Brookneckville. Well, not quite exact copies, for the being apparently named Melphi had a small symbol imprinted on his forehead, a blue ring with a red star. The other occupant, Kelphi, had no such mark. Neither had Delphi, for that matter. Kelphi exited his seat and walked up to the large LAV, inspecting the vehicle while also holding up a small white box.
This vehicle has been severely damaged. Do you wish me to begin nano-reconstruction, Melphi? That is not necessary. I have lost contact with Delphi. It is logical to assume that, like this vehicle, he has ceased to function. He will not need it again.
Kelphi returned to his chair, the scanning device already hidden beneath his flowing robe.
Delphi was arrogant, brash, insolent, impulsive. And his impulsiveness is what has destroyed him, and almost got Tanner killed in the process. We knew his illogical experiments on the bioweapon life forms of Over Project Whisper and his recruiting of the four stagnated humans would end in failure, but he would not listen. Now Tanner and his friends will never trust us.
Melphi rose from his chair and went to the spherical wall. Touching it, the wall immediately became awash in a multitude of images all around them. Scenes from different points in history converged with those same points from an alternate, changed history. A changed history brought about by Operation Kronos' ill-conceived time experiments, and indirectly by one man. The man Delphi had sworn that he would be able to find, Theophilus Tanner. Only Tanner could put right the casement that had been damaged by the long-ago actions of a group of men with evil in their hearts.
What you say is correct, Kelphi. However, it does not negate the fact that because of Delphi's rash actions, we are now lessened in number. The totality concept is no more, over Project Whisper is now dust, and Operation Kronos threatens us less and less as the flow of time continues. Soon, they will be no more, but the damage they have caused will remain. Only Department Coldfire is left. And unless we find Tanna again, there will be nothing to stop the entropy. I tried to help him once long ago, but I failed. We cannot fail again.
Kelphi simply nodded at his superior and lowered his head in his seat. Melphi continued to stare at the mishmash of images in front of him, focusing on two points in particular. One scene showed a giant mushroom cloud detonating over Washington, D.C. There was a timestamp on the image reading January 20th, 2001. The second image showed Washington again, but there wasn't a cloud in sight, radioactive or otherwise. The timestamp was the same. Tanner must be found, Melphi contemplated. The casement must be put right again. That was why Coldfire existed. And the foolish actions of Delphi aside, they were the only ones who could make it happen. He would gladly give up his very existence in order to set the flow of time back to its proper place. Nodding, Melphi returned to his chair and bowed his head, mentally communing with both Kelphi and the vast resources of Department Coldfire in order to locate Tanner again, while the ruined hulk of the Totality Concept-built LAV sat ignored, a testament to the destructive nature of mankind. But mankind would be redeemed. Deathlands, Perdition Valley is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terrence Azelford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Tim Carlin, Karen Carbone, David Coyne, James Lewis, Sonny Lasky, Casey Jones, Nazia Chowdhury, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Vocal editing by Greg Reinfeld and Temeskin Wubna. Graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld, Temeskin Wubna, and Johann Detweiler. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Script adapted for graphic audio by Mark Delgado. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders, available at roadstops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.